We're here at the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission with Dean Baker from the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
Yes, right.
CEPR. And from the FCIC, we have
Alexis Simmendinger,
Tom Stanton,
and Ron Borzakowski. Thank you very much for your time and for joining us today. I think the way we usually start these out is it's meant to be sort of a general conversation and to get your views on the crisis. If you have sort of an overarching story or narrative to what happened and what the important causes were or things you think are not important, if you could lay those out and we can start there and build.
Okay. Well, I really put the housing bubble front and center in the story because to my mind that is, you know, probably 90% of, you know, what went on and what's hit the economy, you know, right up to the moment. And the basic story was that the housing bubble was driving the economy ever since the end of the last recession. So the last recession was created by the collapse of the stock bubble. Officially, the recession is, of course, very short and relatively mild. The official dating is March of 01 until November of 01, which is about as short as a recession could be. But in fact, the economy actually didn't start creating jobs until the fall of 03. My reason for emphasizing this is that it's very difficult to recover from a recession that was the result of the collapse of a financial bubble, asset bubble. And the economy only began to create jobs in 03 based on the growth generated by the housing bubble. So what was going on beginning in 03? Well, I shouldn't say beginning of 03, it began even earlier than that. But what was going on was that because you had this run-up in house prices diverging from fundamentals, you saw a huge increase in construction, sort of building homes at near-record rates, 02 to 06. And then on top of that, and perhaps more important than that, we also had this huge increase in consumption, so that savings rates fell through the floor. So in principle, you would have expected to see savings rates rise because we just lost on the order of $10 trillion in wealth with the collapse of the stock bubble. Now, some of that came back as the stock market came back in 03, 04, 05, 06. But at least initially, the stock market collapsed the bubble, got rid of $10 trillion in wealth, and that, of course, cost a lot of consumption. You would have expected, other things equal, that the savings rate would go back to more normal levels. Instead, the savings rate actually fell to new record lows, basically hitting zero in 2005, 2006. And this is all being driven by the wealth created by the housing bubble. And again, you have this, you know, people running around today, they don't understand why consumers are pessimistic. It's not a question of pessimistic, they don't have money. They had wealth, it's now disappeared. So in any case, the point here was that was what was driving the economy through the last cycle. Now, obviously that was supported by a lot of, you know, really bad, if not outright fraudulent financial practices. So the deterioration of loan quality, the fact that you had no doc loans, you had people giving wrong information, often at the initiative of the issuer. I mean, this helped drive the bubble higher than otherwise would have been possible. Also, you know, I would say it's inconceivable to me this was not known to the actors, because I knew about this because I had people sending me emails from all around the country telling me about their friends and relatives who worked at Countrywide or, you know, other issuers that were being told to fill in numbers for people who wouldn't otherwise qualify for mortgages.
When, if I could interrupt?
This would have been 04, 05, 06, all through that period. And, you know, I assume people were sending me notes because they saw something I was quoted in the paper, or they saw a column I wrote somewhere, you know, obviously I don't have regulatory authority, you know, they just wanted to call someone's attention to it, and they thought, you know, maybe I could do something about it. So, you know, the idea that, you know, the higher-ups at these banks didn't know, it seems inconceivable because, you know, this was clearly a policy. You know, again, I understand someone, you know, sending me an email or not, you know, we don't have them in the room where we can cross-examine them, but the fact I was getting many, I don't think there's a conspiracy to fool Dean Baker, you know, so those are the options, you know. So I do think something like that was true. And, you know, and again, I find it almost inconceivable that the higher-ups at these institutions didn't know, because clearly it was going on a fairly large scale. And then it also, of course, raises the issue, well, didn't the securitizers know it? And that's why I've sort of been inclined to think there's a big element of fraud here, since it's, you know, at the very least, it was deliberate not knowing if they didn't know about this.
Did you ever have a conversation with anyone in the banking community at that time that made you think that they definitely knew?
No, I really don't have a lot of contacts in the banking community, and I sort of figured they wouldn't be anxious to hear me raising these issues, so I never really tried. I mean, I certainly casually had some conversations, so I more likely know some regulators. I might have had some casual conversations, but, you know, I sort of felt at the time that they must have known this, so I just didn't. It seemed almost absurd. Like, how could you not know this? And, you know, so much of this was absolute public knowledge in the sense that we knew the number of loans that were being issued was zero down. Now, do we suddenly have that many more people who are, you know, capable of taking a loan with zero down, who we think are going to be able to pay that off, than was true, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago? I mean, what's changed in the world? I mean, there were a lot of things that were, they didn't require any investigation at all. These were totally available in the data that, you know, you didn't have to ask a lot of questions about. So, you know, I just kind of assumed that there was a general knowledge that these loans were not kind of what we would consider normal kosher loans. So getting back to just the general story, so I think that those sorts of shenanigans drove the bubble much, much further than it otherwise would have. I first wrote about the bubble in 2002, and I knew enough because I was talking about the stock bubble, and people would ask me, you know, when do I think it would burst, and I would foolishly say in about 6 months, and for about 2.5 years it looked really stupid. So I knew enough with the housing bubble, I was not going to say, you know, when I, but if, you know, I really, you know, you assured me you wouldn't tell me anyone, you'd ask me anywhere from, you know, 2002 onward, I'd probably say about 6 months or a year, because the internet price is pretty out of line. You go, how long could this be maintained? And of course it got maintained way longer than I thought possible, and I think the answer to that was that you had loans made that it's just astounding were ever made. You know, that they really, it should have been evident to everyone involved that these were bad loans. And that, so that allowed the bubble to last much longer, prices to go much higher, and then obviously create much, much more damage when you eventually had the collapse. Now again, I always emphasize that I think the real story here, the real economy story is the big issue here. You've lost a huge amount of wealth. So I don't, there's a lot of people who are saying, well, the financial system isn't working. There are problems with the financial system, but I don't think the downturn right now is, you know, in any important way due to the non-workings or improper workings of the financial system. I think it's all very straightforward. If you lose $6 trillion in wealth, you expect to see people consuming a lot less, and that's what we're seeing. We also lost, of course, the stock market plunged as well, so there you lost somewhere in the order of $6 trillion in stock wealth as well. So the fact that we've seen a rise in the savings rate, that's perfectly explicable. We've seen a huge fall off in construction. Again, we had enormous overbuilding. Why would anyone build? And to some extent, we also had a bubble, of course, in non-residential. You can, you know, basically follows the same pattern, not quite as large, but it's about a year later, but follows the exact same pattern. So to my mind, most of the story is with the real economy. It gets supported, obviously, by the financial sector, because, you know, that's obviously you have to finance the operation, but it really is a real economy story. And I see the financial aspects of it as being, to some extent, secondary. So financial crisis, I understand it's a financial crisis, but I'm more inclined to call it an economic crisis.
Our enabling statute actually tells us to look at the causes of both the financial crisis and the economic crisis.
Good, so I came to the right place.
You came to the right place. So this huge run-up in consumption looks to start at the beginning of the story through 2006. As house prices are rising, do you see this is a story that consumption is being financed by equity extraction?
In part, you know, you did have a lot of people directly drawing on the wealth in their home, either through refinance or home equity mortgages, and people have tried to quantify that. Greenspan had a few papers trying to quantify that. It's clear a lot of that was going on, but even without that, you'd expect that people would be drawing on the wealth of their home, if for no other reason than they may not put aside as much in retirement account or other savings as they would have otherwise, because, you know, basically their home's doing it for them. Why should they? Home went up in value $20,000 or $30,000. You know, why do you have to put aside $10,000 in a 401k? I'm sure a lot of people were thinking along those lines.
Which explains that why even an unrealized gain and an unrealized loss with the collapse would lead to the wealth effects and consumption that you're.
Exactly. And, you know, if you look at where things sit now with the demographics, you have the huge baby boom cohort right at the edge of retirement. Some are already retired, of course, but right at the edge. They have very little wealth. We've done some analysis based on the Fed's survey of consumer finance, the recent one we just projected out, you know, given what we know has happened to house prices and stock prices. And you get the median older baby boomer, people between 55 and 64, their wealth, including their housing equity, is about $170,000. So that's the median. So that leaves you with very little. You know, basically you could buy the median priced home and, you know, pay off your mortgage, and you have nothing else left. For younger baby boomers, 45 to 54, it's about $80,000. So you're looking at this huge cohort that's approaching retirement with very, very little. So it's certainly understandable that they would be trying to save now, because particularly when, you know, there are issues raised about cutting Social Security, these people are approaching retirement with very little to look to support themselves.
If you looked at the data, what's your sense in terms of the increase in wealth during the bubble, at least nominal increase in wealth, versus the decrease now?
I'd say about 75% of the bubble's deflated. There are issues about the right index because the Case-Shiller index just came into existence in, I forget, 03, 04, and of course I was using the house price index before that. The Case-Shiller index I consider a much better index because it doesn't the house price index just uses loans, conformable loans, of course, so it excluded a lot of the subprime, and today, so on the upside, it did pick up everything on the upside, so you had a big uptick in the subprime portion of the market. And then on the downside, it misses bank-owned properties. So that's also not being picked up. So it's hard. That's why I'm saying I can't answer your question as precisely as I'd like because the measures aren't perfect. But I would say somewhere around 3/4 of in real terms, of the wealth has disappeared.
What I'm trying to get at, excuse my frog in my throat, what I'm trying to get at is the extent to which people lost wealth they never had because it was the bubble, and the extent to which they might have lost more wealth than they gained during the bubble.
Well, it's hard to break that out because what you had to deal with was people's responses to wealth that was imaginary. So in a sense, the biggest loss, let's say that I'm sitting there and I see my home double in value, as has happened in many places of Las Vegas, many areas in Florida, and then it falls back and I'm back where I was. If I just sort of looked at that and said, oh, that's nice, and then it disappears, well, of course I'm upset, but everything's fine, so I just kept doing everything. But people responded to that wealth. So what happened was people spent as though the wealth was real. Now, the bubble didn't cause it, it's not directly that it killed their wealth, but they thought, why shouldn't they, that bubble wealth was real. So people didn't save in years where they certainly should have, because these were, in many cases, their peak earning years, and they weren't putting anything aside because they didn't see a need to, given the amount of equity they had in their home.
Mm-hmm. Since you put much more of the story on the housing bubble, let's just stay there for a minute. And you mentioned a bit of this, the securitizers. Let's think about this along the securitizing chain, what people might have been thinking and what was rational or not. I think sort of, as an economist, it's always hard. We don't like to think that lots of people all make that same mistake repeatedly that's against their own self-interest. Could be wrong about that. I'm not really willing.
I generally like to think that.
You like to think that. Yeah. So from the point of view of, let's say, homeowners who are watching house prices rise or who are spending, who are taking the bubble as real wealth or who are not believing it's a bubble, are these guys acting rationally as they either refi or extract equity, cash out, move up in homes?
Absolutely. I mean, it's totally rational behavior given that belief. So if that wealth had been real, there's no reason on earth. That's why, you have these people running around the scolds about us being spendthrifts. Well, if that was real wealth, then perfectly reasonable thing. If your house had just gone up in value $50,000, what's wrong with taking $10,000 out to buy a new car, take a vacation, whatever you might do? Maybe you're sending your kid through college. I mean, it might be perfect. It might actually be something we consider investment. But but it's a perfectly rational thing to spend a portion of your wealth as long as that wealth's real, and you were certainly being told by just about everyone that that wealth was real.
Were there signs as early as 2002 or 2003 that we were beginning to bubble, that somehow house prices were diverting from fundamentals? By 05, 06, that's clearly true. I mean, rent, ratios relative to rent or things like that start going out of line. But what about earlier?
Well, I was looking at 02 already. The real house prices had risen by 30% from their mid-90s level. And at that time, Shiller has since gone back and constructed his index going to the 90s, 1890s. But at that time, we had government data dating back from the 1950s. So I was looking at that. And from 1950, that's not exactly 50, it might be 52 or 53, but from the early 50s till 96, house prices have just tracked the overall rate of inflation. So you get a pretty sharp divergence. 30%, in a market that large is a pretty sharp divergence, with no obvious explanation of the fundamentals. And nothing at all comparable in rents. So there's a little bit of an uptick in real rents. In other words, rents slightly outpaced inflation through the late 90s, but that stops with the recession. And also the uptick was not that much, it was like 4 or 5 percentage points. So it wasn't nowhere near the same size as house sale prices. And then on top of that, you also have a record vacancy rate. It was showing up on the rental side, but already by 2002, you had a record nationwide vacancy rate, which should have raised some eyebrows. I mean, if you're seeing a big run-up in prices, that's not generally consistent with an oversupply. And again, it was showing up on the rental side. But on the other hand, these are, at the end of the day, one market. If you're sitting there with a unit you can't rent and you have condos that are selling for ridiculously, you convert them. There's costs, but, you know, at the end of the day, we don't expect to see a huge divergence there. So I thought already by 2002 there were some pretty big signs that something wasn't right.
Is there anything to the argument, or how do you view the argument that, you know, starting, let's say, with the growth of securitization through the 80s, but then really ramping up from the mid-90s on, there's additional capital that's now available for housing, a new source of finance outside of, you know, the local savings and loan, that, you know, much like after World War II, you see sort of there's a structural break in the series of home ownership, that we might expect to see the same thing. You know, there's the financing is going to create a demand side effect, and therefore some house price increase, maybe 30% over 5 years, is fine. That's acceptable. We're not bubbling yet.
Yeah. Well, the whole post-war period is, of course, one of, you know, innovations in the supply of mortgage financing, and we saw, you know, increased availability of financing through a number of different mechanisms. Certainly HUD, you know, and certainly increased. I mean, securitization begins in the 80s. It's not or a large scale. You know, so it wasn't altogether new. Obviously, it spread much more in the late 90s than the beginning of the last decade. So there was not, I think you'd be very hard-pressed to find any evidence of an uptick in pricing, or any notable uptick in pricing associated with any of those prior innovations. So this really would have been a qualitative break with prior innovations. And also, just another point on that is that at the end of the day, you know, interest rates, I mean, this should in some sense, you know, interest rates being, of course, the supply, the price of credit, we should expect, if that were true, we should expect to see a much stronger relationship between interest rates and house prices than we in fact do. So I was always very skeptical that you could explain very much by financial innovation, because A, it didn't seem to have a notable effect in prior periods, and this wasn't the first time you had innovation, and B, it's just, you know, you could look at some pretty big changes in interest rates, and you're pretty hard-pressed to find much, I'm not going to say it's zero, but you don't find anything like a 30% uptick in prices, and even in response to fairly large changes, whether you want them nominal or real. I mean, you could find periods where there's both, you know, and you just really don't find that sort of impact on prices.
Are there other housing policy changes, any other regulatory changes that you attribute, let's say, from the mid-90s, you know, this mid-90s to 2002, 30% increase, when you're considering already sort of getting to the point where you're already seeing it as a bubble and raising flags?
Yeah.
Are there any other sort of potential precipitating causes that you've identified?
Not really, not that I could think of. I mean, you know, looking at the Glass-Steagall, I mean, a lot of people, of course, made an issue of Glass-Steagall's repeal. I don't really see any, you know, any relationship directly other than just sort of a more lax regulatory attitude. But there's nothing I could say directly, you know, I wouldn't say Glass-Steagall directly in any way I could see contributed to the bubble. You know, the other changes in policy, well, probably when you get to 2004, you know, with the decision of the SEC to allow the investment banks to become much more heavily leveraged, obviously that played a role in the securitization, allowing that to go much, much further than otherwise would have. But prior to 2002, I don't really see any big changes in the regulatory structure that allowed something that otherwise would have been prevented.
One of the statements that has constantly attracted my attention was Alan Greenspan's statement that what surprised him most was the number of institutions that failed to protect their own interests or those of their shareholders. What's your sense of what happened?
Well, you know, again, this is speculation on my part, but my guess is that you had people thinking very, very short term, that they were looking to make profits this quarter, next quarter, and they're getting bonuses based on short term profits, they're getting rewarded based on short term profits, they're doing the same thing everyone else is, and there was this idea that, you know, there's sort of one-sided risk in this story. If you make the same mistake that everyone else does, you don't pay a price for it. So you're making money, everything's fine, things go bad, well, you worry about that when it happens. But if you were to, let's say, even be right, let's imagine that, you know, one of the top executives at Goldman or Citi or, you know, someone really in a position to have some impact on the market and notice with it, they had said, we're not going to do this. This is really risky. These are, you know, things can go south and, you know, we're not prepared for that. I think it would have been a really difficult thing for that person to have done. They would have drawn a huge amount of heat. They would have said, you know, everyone else is doing this. They're making big profits. You don't want us to take part in these profits. It would have been a very, very difficult thing for them to do, even if they'd been right, which, of course, we could say in retrospect they were, but they didn't know that. You couldn't possibly know, you know, in 04, 05, 06 that this would blow up. So even if you're pretty sure of this, you don't know it for 100%. So you're taking a really big risk that guarantees putting you in hot water. And, you know, maybe you'll prove to be right, but you don't know that for sure. And even if you prove to be right, you may still be out of a job. So I think you had a question, you had a situation of very asymmetric incentives that, you know, as it turned out, how many of the people who, you know, took their companies down, I guess, followed, although I guess he has another job with a hedge fund, right? You know, I mean, if you go around, you go, who actually suffered in any notable way from having made really, really wrong decisions for their companies? You know, obviously, people at Citigroup made really wrong decisions. Robert Rubin walked away with $110 million. You know, you go around, these people didn't really suffer. I mean, obviously they would have been better off if things just kept going up and they were still sitting there. But, you know, most of us, I think, would probably be like to be suffering the way they're suffering.
Let's set aside the ex post. Are you telling the same story about homeowners who saw house price appreciations and went out, took on risks they didn't understand, made more money, so to speak, by extracting wealth from their homes that in the end wasn't there? Is that essentially the same story you're now describing for the heads of these firms? Forget about the fact that they seem to have come out better to a significant extent than the homeowners, but is that the same phenomenon, that everything's going up and therefore we're being rational?
Well, let me, there's some similarities, but I think there's some very, very important differences in the sense that the homeowners, I don't think, are in a position to independently evaluate the housing market. I mean, this is the job of the top executives at, you know, major banks, to understand the markets that they're in. So that is their job. The homeowner is in this sense sort of a information taker rather than an information generator. So I think there's a very, very important difference there. The second is that, as I said, that I think, even though I don't, you know, again, I don't know any of these people, so I don't know what was really going through their heads, but even though they may not have thought, I don't think most of them thought this was about to blow up. I don't think, you know, if we look back and maybe you've talked to some of them, I think you have talked to some of them, I know that actually. But in any case, I don't think many of them thought this is about to explode. But they had little reason to entertain that because they could insulate themselves, and in that sense they knew that. So it's sort of, you know, you have kind of this kind of bad scenario that they must in some way know is out there. Even if they've not thought it through and thought, you know, it's a big bubble and it's all going to burst, they must know bad things in the world could happen. But they also know that they're largely insulated from that. So in that sense, they had a different set of options about the world than, say, the homeowner, who the homeowner sitting there, their home went up in value to $400,000, they go out and spend money, and now it's down to $200,000. There's not something they could then turn to that gets them out of this jam.
Do you believe they also had a built-in belief that there was a trust, that there were watchdogs on the case?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think they were being told. I argued with a lot of these people. House prices never fall. You know, that, you know.
They being who, sorry?
Homeowners. Homeowners, okay. Were being told. House price, you know, I debated, you know, the chief economist at Freddie Mac any number of times. You know, house prices, nationwide house prices never fall. And David Lira, the chief economist for the realtors, the guy, I'm forgetting his name now, was at Fannie Mae, was a little more cautious. He said there are some markets that there are troubles, but, you know, basically also very reassuring. You know, and of course, Alan Greenspan himself saying, you know, everything's basically fine. So I think there was...
Was this that you were debating Freddie's chief economist and these other people about?
What period?
The first time I recall debating them was 02, December of 02. We debated before the FDIC. I remember they had a meeting that we were invited to, a session to debate the housing market. I had several different debates with them at different points, so 02 to 06.
Their version of irrational exuberance?
Yes, yes. And, you know, again, in fairness, I'd say, I don't know why his name's escaping me, though, the chief economist, I don't know if he's still there at Fannie, was a little more...
Burson?
Burson, that's right, David Burson. is a little more cautious. And
so talk about the regulation part of it. Talk about the culpability there, in your view.
Well, I put a lot right at the doorstep of the Fed, because, you know, their responsibilities have to include preventing financial, you know, asset bubbles of the type we saw with the stock market and also the housing market, because clearly that's inconsistent with maintaining price stability and full employment, as we now see. But I think that was foreseeable with foresight, not just hindsight. So the fact that they either did not see or did not take any actions against the bubble.
Do you believe they could not see?
No.
No,
I absolutely, you know, Greenspan, they saw the stock bubble. You go back and read their minutes, their transcripts. They absolutely saw the stock bubble. And Greenspan basically said that. I remember his speech he gave at the ASSA in January of 2004, where he pretty openly said, we saw the stock bubble. We decided the best thing to do was just let it run its course and pick up its pieces. And he's patting himself on the back, and that was the right thing to do. That's not how I saw it, because, you know, to my mind, I look at that period, as I was saying, we didn't create jobs from March of 2001 until September of 2003. And, you know, we didn't get back the jobs we had lost until, I think it was January of 2005. So to say that that was somehow, you know, oh, it was the right thing to do, no big deal. No, you had a lot of people out of work for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. In addition, of course, to the people who lost wealth. You know, again, it wasn't as dramatic as with the housing bubble, but you did have people who thought they had wealth in a 401k. They weren't necessarily trying. Yeah, I mean, you had the day traders, and they say, so you got what you deserve. But, you know, people just put their money in 401k thinking that they were fine, you know, and saw the stock market fall by 50%. So I don't think that was a mild thing. But, you know, getting back to the initial question, he did see the stock bubble, and it's hard for me to believe that they didn't have discussions. And I should go back. I have not read the most recent transcripts that have been released that would, you know, cover this period. They had to have talked about it. It's inconceivable they didn't talk about it. And, you know, whether they were firmly convinced that there was a bubble, that I don't know. But I think I was once debating Ned Gramlich, because I knew him. He was at my school. He was the chair of the department. I was at Michigan grad school. And, you know, we stayed in contact a little bit. So we once had a debate, and I was kidding him. It was an open debate. And I said, no, Ned's going to tell us, given that Greenspan made a decision not to talk about the stock bubble, even though he knew one, whether he would talk about the housing bubble if he knew there was a housing bubble. And they got real sheepish, and he goes, no. And then everyone said it, because the media there said it. So you're saying he wouldn't? He goes, no, I'm not going to answer that. So anyhow, though, they obviously had discussions about it. Whether they had come to a firm conviction, I don't know. I mean, again, I didn't see any serious evidence on the other side. I mean, I know, and I'll have to read this, the Boston Fed just came out a study that said, well, if you look at it, the case was actually ambiguous. I'll have to see what they see was ambiguous, because to my mind it wasn't. I mean, you had a momentous change in valuation in the largest market in the world that we had never seen before, and there was nothing that fits in terms of the fundamental story. So, I mean, the issue about finance, I just, you know, maybe a little bit, maybe temporarily, you know, everything. I mean, Greenspan, I first started looking at this closely, because Greenspan had given testimony in the spring of 2002. I don't think it was Humphrey Hawkins' testimony. I forget who he was testifying before, but it shouldn't be hard to track down. Where, and again, I don't know if he was asked the question or brought it up on his own, but he went through the argument saying, you know, that there is no housing bubble. It's explained by the fundamentals. And none of the things he said made any sense. He first said, well, incomes, you know, have been rising. And you go, well, incomes were rising at a healthy pace in the late 90s, but A, that wasn't unprecedented. You look through the whole early post-war period, you know, the 50s and 60s and 70s, you had that year after year after year for a quarter century, and there's no, you know, housing bubble. And B, that had ended by 2000, so you got the recession, so fine, if, you know, it was an income story, that might have explained some increase in the 90s, surely it couldn't, you know, explain a further increase 2001, 2002, when incomes were falling, not rising. He said population, and this one is just, oh, come on, you know, we're, you know, the baby boomers are through their years of, you know, house buying, you know, so, you know, there might have been a story for the 80s, you know, maybe as late as early 90s, but certainly not late 90s, 2000s. And he said immigration, you know, well, immigration, the impact of immigration, demographic impact of immigration is swamped by the baby boomers. And on top of that, I mean, don't tell me that new immigrants are buying $400,000 homes. I mean, it turned out some of them were, but I mean, that's another story. That's part of the problem, not the explanation. And then he said on the supply side, he said, you know, we have environmental restrictions on building. And you go, well, come on, you know, environmental restrictions on building aren't new. I mean, my brother used to live in the Bay Area and just across from San Francisco, you know, the Marin Headlands. Well, the reason Marin Headlands are there is it used to be an Army base. It was decommissioned, I think, in 60, and the people in the area said, we want to save this as a park. You know, it's a beautiful area that, you know, it's right across from San Francisco. You can imagine what this would have been worth as a, you know, as a development. So it's not new that we had environmental restrictions on building. This wasn't the heyday of environmentalism, not with the, you know, the political...
So what was going on?
Well, as I say, it was a bubble.
None of these other factors drove that bubble. What did?
Oh, I think it originated with the stock bubble. I think it was the exact same thing as what you had in Japan in the 80s, that you had a stock bubble and real estate bubble going side by side. So in Japan, they fed directly off each other, and when one burst, they both burst, you know, in 1990. Here you had a somewhat different story. So what happened was when the stock bubble burst, I think it actually reinforced the housing bubble in two ways. One was the response that burst the stock bubble, of course, was we sent interest rates plummeting. So, you know, so that made it easier for people to buy homes, help sustain the momentum. The other is simply this attitude shift that, you know, okay, stocks are really speculative, you know, there's sheets of paper, but you could always live in your home. You know, so housing was safe. So I think the collapse of the stock bubble, quite the opposite of what happened in Japan, bringing down the housing bubble actually helped to reinforce the growth of the housing bubble here.
And just to understand this point, some people have argued that something must be qualitatively different this time than the tech bubble. Right? So by some measures, $11 trillion in lost wealth in both cases or something of the sort. And yet, I mean, yes, there was the recession, but I mean, the employment picture, there was the quote-unquote, you know, the jobless recovery of the early 2000s. But in terms of recession, it was two quarters long, as you pointed out.
Yeah.
We're now on, I don't know if the MBER will date this recession to be.
Yeah.
It's clearly
it's much more serious.
So what if these are both the result of sort of this popping of the bubble on the real side, what's different?
Well, two things. One is that there was more real activity driven, certainly in construction, than there was the sort of tech-related garbage investment. I mean, you know, I'm using a crude term here, but the point being, there was some investment clearly we would have wanted. There was a lot of investment that was crazy, that, you know, someone realized they could put junk.com, sell it for, you know, a new issue for $200 million and do whatever, you know, make papier-mâché palace, and some people were doing that, you know. But fortunately, the absolute amount of that was much, much smaller than what was going into residential construction. So in residential construction, at the peaks, we were talking about, you know, the share of GDP going to 6.2%. This is just the residential side, because we also had non-residential, but just the residential, 6.2% GDP against what we might think it should have been somewhere around 3.5% given prior trends. So you're talking about 2.7 percentage points of GDP, plus given the overbuilding, you know, the sustainable rate for, you know, next couple of years going forward, we're probably talking about around 2% of GDP. So we've had a huge fall off in demand related to, you know, this enormous overbuilding in construction, residential and non-residential, residential being more important, but also non-residential. The other part is that the wealth, the housing wealth effect, and this isn't just me, I think just about everyone agrees on this, the housing wealth effect is considerably larger than the stock wealth effect, because stock is disproportionately held by higher end people, so it has much less impact on, you know, Bill Gates' consumption than, you know, someone in a middle class family that has a home that goes from 200 to 400,000. So even if you have a comparable size loss in wealth, because so much more of it was housing wealth, so much of it's housing wealth, but with a much bigger wealth effect, it has a much bigger impact on consumption.
So this version of the story is an interesting one, because it means we could have had a severe recession simply with the popping of the bubble, but without the destruction or near destruction of the financial system, the credit intermediation sector. All right, so between August of 07 and the end of 08, we did in fact, you know, securitization came to a halt, the asset-backed commercial paper market ceases, the investment banks go away, commercial banking sector gets harmed substantially, and never mind the originators and the thrifts, thinking about them all.
Yeah.
So you don't, what's your view on the role of that and potentially the credit crunch after that and the role of that effect of credit going away from the destruction of all these firms?
Well, I think that clearly accelerated the downturn. I mean, I think anyone could look at those numbers, look what was going on through the fall of 08 and early 09 and not see that there had been a very sharp acceleration. But I think it basically got us where we would have been anyhow. And I would say that, you know, to a large extent at this point, the financial system is pretty much operating. So it's not, you know, you can construct a story. Let's imagine a counterfactual where we hadn't done anything to support the financial system. We just had a 30s type collapse. You know, the banks just wiped out, no FDIC or equivalent, you know. We'd certainly be looking at something much, much worse than we have today. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But I think the measures that were taken by the Treasury and Fed were effective in countering that, so that we do today have a financial system that's pretty much working. And the argument about a credit crunch, I mean, this always happens in a downturn. I was kidding with people. I took some quotes and saying, yeah, here's some people saying how bad the credit crunch is. And I go, oh, wow. And one was from Alan Greenspan saying, I've never seen anything like this. It's from 92. You know, that's what happens in a downturn. I mean, you know, obviously businesses that had previously been very healthy or good credit risk suddenly look much less creditworthy in a downturn. So I don't think that, you know, I'm not going to say there's zero consequence today of the financial fallout, but I think it's very, very much secondary. And just sort of two points I'd make that, to my mind, you know, make that argument compelling. On the side of the banks, we know there's many banks that remain troubled, but there are many banks that aren't. So what we would expect to see if there's all these good lending opportunities is the banks that aren't should see this as a great opportunity to steal market share. And maybe that's going on, but I haven't heard of that. I mean, so we should be seeing some of the ones that were cautious, you know, really rushing out and, you know, eating their competitors' lunch. And I don't see that. Again, I may be missing it, but I don't see that. And on the side of the small businesses, the story there that, you know, we know small businesses have difficulty getting credit right now, but on the other hand, for big firms, it's never been easier. They could issue stock, issue bonds at record low interest rates. And again, if it were the case that their smaller competitors were being hobbled by lack of access to credit so they couldn't take advantage of investment opportunities, we should expect to see the big companies running around like crazy, you know, taking advantage of this, expanding these markets. And again, they're not doing that. You know, Walmart just came out with their numbers yesterday. They don't see that they're going to have a chance to expand at the expense of small retailers. So I don't really think it's a financial story. I think this is what we should expect to see, given that you had a huge bubble driving the economy, and that's now largely deflated.
So it's an aggregate demand story, both on the way up and the way down.
Yeah, yeah.
And how long do you think the recovery is going to have to project for?
If we don't do some serious stimulatory policy, you know, it's something beyond what's currently on the agenda, I think we could be sitting here with high rates of unemployment, you know, 6-7 years out. Because the basic story is you need something to replace that lost demand, the lost construction, the lost consumption. Investment is not going to do that because investment, you're not going to see a lot of investment in a climate of very weak demand growth. Now, over time, you will see we do have a growing population. You will eventually see the oversupply of housing eroded, so you will start to see over time eventually construction, return to more normal levels. But that's a process that's going to take 5-6 years. The other part of the story that I would expect to see, and again, who knows, though, you know, this is one, you know, I'd be the last person to guess at what actually will happen is, you know, we really should be seeing the dollar fall. I mean, we have an overvalued dollar that leads to a very large trade imbalance, and in principle, that's where you'd look to see much of the demand made up, that we'd move somewhere closer to balanced trade. But, you know, that will depend on a lot of factors, political decisions by the Chinese government, what happens with the euro. Whether the dollar, it wouldn't shock me at this point if the dollar's higher 5 years from now than it is today.
You're describing a lost generation.
It's a serious, yeah. No, this is a really serious, you know, downturn. It's not something you get over quickly. And I think we could with aggressive policy, but I also know the politics. I mean, you know, it's the prospect of getting a big stimulus through is very poor. The Fed could do much more aggressive policy, but there seems very little willingness to do that. I mean, Bernanke actually wrote about this back when he was still at Princeton, the idea of targeting a higher inflation rate, which I think would make a lot of sense. I think got from Krugman, but in any case, you know, having a 3 or 4% inflation rate would go a long way towards A, reducing real interest rates, and then B, reducing the debt burden, give people some equity back in their homes. So those are policies I think would both make a lot of sense, but politically they don't seem terribly likely right now.
Is there anything in the mix now that you see are seeds of the next crisis to come? If stock leads to housing, what's the continuum?
No, I really hard to see. I mean, you know, you have a lot going on in different markets. You know, for example, the gold market, I don't follow it that closely, but it really gone through the roof. If that were to fall by 50%, I don't see big consequences of that. So people have talked to me, you know, like I'm a bubble fanatic, you know, because they talked about stock and housing. And, you know, the view is stock can move the economy, housing can move the economy. There aren't many other, you know, items out there that we could think of where if there's a bubble, it's really going to have a big impact on the economy. It can have a big impact on that sector. You know, arguably oil, that may fit that bill. You know, that's an arguable case. But, you know, gold, I just don't see that. You have people that speculate in gold, and obviously they'll be wiped out. Most of us are, you know, most people probably have some gold somewhere, you know, but doesn't affect their buying patterns, doesn't affect their view of how wealthy they are if gold were to double in price or fall 50%. So there aren't that many commodities where if there were a big bubble in them, they have, you know, significant economy-wide impacts. That's why, you know, I don't think it's the Fed's job to be policing every commodity market and saying, oh, I think oil's too high, I don't, you know, because that would be silly. But housing moves the economy, stock moves the economy. Those markets, you know, it's part of their responsibility in having macro oversight of the economy.
I'd like to go to the micro for a minute. You talked a bit about fraud, and you talked about what might be called reckless disregard of financials on the part of the lenders.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, we've had people come in and talk to us. When you have a mortgage broker and a borrower coming to the table, and the borrower's income comes out of that process overstated 5 times, how do we figure out who's committing fraud?
I think it's a question of how frequently it occurred. You know, if you have a you know, lender where, you know, people do lie sometimes, you know, and if, you know, basically they had a clean record, but every now and then someone came through and had clearly overstated income, and I think it's reasonable to assume that they tried to be responsible in verifying income and, you know, trying to do what they could to make sure the information they passed along was truthful, and some number of people got through. On the other hand, where you have a lender where it's very frequent, I think you have to assume this policy.
Are there other parts, again, staying with this micro theme and where we were earlier, from the originator's point of view, what's their rationale to lie on the income and to keep pushing a loan into this pipeline?
Well, of course, the mortgage brokers are paid on commission. They have to, you know, they get paid by issuing the loan, and oftentimes, you know, as I'm sure you know, that commissions were higher for the worst loans, you know, more risky loans from the standpoint of the borrowers. So they had every incentive in the world to push through a bad loan because they didn't suffer any consequences. Totally one-sided. If they got the loan through, they got the commission. End of story.
But there had to be somebody someplace that was underwriting that loan. And where were they in this process? I mean, it's sort of a rare phenomenon that I can walk into my banker and they force money on me. To the point where they're happy if I overstay my income substantially.
Well, this gets back to the securitization. So that's why the securitization was so central, that they knew they could pass along almost anything to the investment banks and, you know, very few questions asked, obviously.
Because I'm buying that loan.
Yeah.
Because I can look out and see that, for example, this particular originator seems to have a whole lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Or I've listened to Dean Baker, and I think there's a bunch of fraud and predatory lending, whatever it is, these are misrepresented files. I'm still willing to buy them.
Yeah. Well, you know, from the standpoint of the investment banks, if they could go ahead and go to the bond rating agencies and get investment grade ratings, you know, they just put down a paper. I actually didn't know this. I felt stupid, but I thought the bond rating agencies actually did due diligence. I thought they actually, you know, looked through the, you know, the you know, I didn't think they looked at every single loan, but I thought, you know, you take a, what I had assumed was, you know, here's a mortgage-backed security, there's, you know, 1,000, 2,000 loans in there, I'm going to pick out 50 at random and, you know, see that everything seems to check out. They don't do that. They just go, okay, here's, you know, 2,000 loans and, you know, so many of them have 20% down and go, okay, good. Hey, you know, give them investment grade rating. So once you had that, there was very little incentive for the investment banks to pay attention to what they're putting in there. You basically had a chain where, you know, the only person who gets stuck at the end of the day was the buyer, often institutional investors, but some of them no doubt wealthy individuals, whatever, buyers of the mortgage-backed securities or collateral, whatever, sometimes more complex instruments, who didn't realize what they were doing. They should have. It's hard for me to understand. I mean, when I was reading about the Goldman Sachs story, what the SEC charged them on, I mean, you know, Goldman Sachs line was that they were dealing with a sophisticated buyer, which they were. I mean, they were dealing with a major insurance company. I have no idea what these people thought when they're getting this, you know, CDO with all these, you know, subprime properties in Las Vegas that, you know, I don't know what they were doing, but apparently, you know, you had buyers out there that, you know, they saw the bond rating and that was the end of the story. Good enough for me.
So it's a continuum of that kind of trust.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, I should mention one other part, which I'm sure you've had this already, but, you know, at the other side, right at the very beginning, I discovered this because I have a friend who's a realtor who he was telling me about with appraisers. They, you know, they had an incentive, of course. Appraisers are typically independent contractors. So they would hire the appraisers who they knew would give them a high number. You know, and the appraisers, of course, understood that. So they knew that they should come in with a high number if they want to get hired. So, you know,
and there was no penalty.
There was no penalty, right. You know, why on earth, you know, you see, you know, I don't think they totally make a number out of air, but you see a house that you might think would $250 be a fair price. Well, you could put down $270, $280, and you know that will make the lender happy, and you'll be called back again.
How do we document that?
You probably could get appraisers who would tell you that. I mean, there were some that were writing about that. I had a few send me emails over the course of this period, you know, that they knew that they had to inflate their appraisals because otherwise they wouldn't get hired.
That's why the procedures have now changed.
Yeah, yeah, that's right, which is a kind of common sense thing. I was, you know, sort of wondering, like, what was, you know, since our thing with the bond rating agencies, although that got watered down in the final version of the financial reform bill, so the SEC is supposed to issue a study. We'll see what that says.
You know, there's been a lot of discussion about how there was an assumption by some of the highest policymakers, regulators, that financial institutions would always act in their self-interest, that they would never do things that would be self-injurious. Can you talk a little bit about that assumption that in a very complicated world they were doing what was in their self-interest?
I think you have to ask who's doing the acting. So invariably you have people who are acting for the firm, and I think the top officers, the top executives at firms were acting in their self-interest. It may well have not been in the interest of the firm, and that's a really big problem, that we often have cases where management's incentives don't align with the interests of the firm. And I think this is really, you know, taking it to the extreme, where they were engaged in activities that, again, I think they had to have at least some sense they were very risky. So even if they haven't done all the analysis and said, look, we got this big bubble here, it's about to burst, I don't know whether it's next month or next year or 2 years, even if they hadn't done to that point, they had to have some sense that this was very risky. But they didn't have to consider that because that risk had very little downside for them. They had to know that it had downside for the firm, you know, for the shareholders, but it had very little downside for them. So they had a situation of very asymmetric incentives that as long as they went ahead, took this risk, and could book the high profits, they were doing very well. They were rewarded. They stayed at the top of the company. If they had strayed from that, if they tried to be more cautious and ostensibly look out for the interests of the shareholders, they would have taken very, very big risks.
So the risk benefits equation had diverged.
That's right. That's
got
right.
Off track.
That's right. For the executives, yeah.
For the executives.
Yeah.
We talked about appraisal reform. If you were to recommend reforms this time around to correct against some of the problems that we've seen, what would they look like? Not that we are necessarily going to recommend reforms, but that sheds light on sort of the analysis of the problem.
Well, there's a lot of different angles on this. I mean, one, the just obvious one, and I was amazed that it did get taken out, was the bond rating agencies. I mean, that was just, you know, that you not have the bond rating agencies picked by the issuer. You know, so you have some independent body. It could be the SEC, as was in the legislation, but the main point is it's someone other than the issuer, just so, mm-hmm. so you take away the incentive for the rating agencies to issue overly favorable ratings. Some of the things, you know, these were in the bill, you know, that banks have to, issuers have to keep a stake in loans that are securitized. You know, I think they end up with 5%. I forget, I should know that, but I think it was have to keep at least a 5% stake. That might have happened anyhow, because I think that would, you know, at this point, it would give people assurance, give buyers at the end of the day assurance that...
If I'm a securitizer and I keep 5% in a world of derivatives, what's to prevent me from going out and simply shorting that 5% position so, in fact, I don't have any exposure?
There's nothing to prevent you from doing that. And, you know, so I don't think it's any sort of sure guarantee. I think it's a good idea to have it, but there's nothing to prevent someone from shorting that position and protecting themselves that way, and I'm sure many will. I would say, you know, a little bit of a divergence, but I don't think that much of one. I think looking at the financial sector in general, I think there's a lot of waste there, a lot of rent there, and there are very big returns to innovation that might serve very little purpose. I mean, the collateralized debt obligations, synthetic collateralized debt obligations, I think you have to scratch your head a long time before you figure out how is that serving a useful economic purpose. So I think having financial transactions tax that, you know, would raise the cost of some of these things. You're not going to make them illegal, but you'll raise the cost. I think that would discourage some of this gaming, some of this rent seeking, which I think would be all to the good. Again, if you know, by definition, if you have a modest tax, it can't exclude something that's very productive, because if it's very productive, you'll pay the tax. You know, you'll go ahead and do it, you'll pay the tax, you'll be unhappy, but you know, you'll still go ahead and do it. So I think a modest financial tax can go a long way in reducing some of the manipulations that we saw. I think, you know, this goes beyond the financial sector, but again, it's most extreme in the financial sector. I think we do have to do something to make corporate executives more accountable, at least to shareholders. I mean, you could argue about other stakeholders in the firm, and I'm sympathetic to some of those arguments, but, you know, at the very least, they should be accountable to shareholders, and I don't think they are now. I mean, you have a situation where, you know, the management basically controls the company to a large extent in their own interest. It's very difficult for shareholders. It's a collective action problem. It's a very difficult situation for shareholders to act collectively to dump bad management, and the conventional wisdom is you don't like what they're doing, you just sell the stock. You know, so it's... There's not good checks on, you know, on management, at least in many, many cases. And I think this is just a basically corporate governance problem, that we have a system of corporate governance that might have worked well, you know, with the system of ownership we had 40 years ago. It does not work well where you have so many institutional investors that are find it very easy to buy and sell stock.
So what is the potential solution there?
Well, I think doing things that would give... you know, more direct control to shareholders, having them directly elect executives, having only directly voted shares count, so you don't have cases where you have someone voting, you know, mutual fund voting shares that, you know, that people have no idea about, you know, so having only directly voted shares count in those elections, basically sort of rig up the rules that make it much more difficult for the corporate insiders to control the game. And, you know, again, that's a long project. I don't guess I have the whole answer to it, but I think it's really important to make it so that they can't run the firm in their interest. Because basically what you have now is the top management picks the executives. Executives, directors get paid, you know, enormous fees for God knows what. You know, what do they do? Go to 4, 5, 6 meetings a year and get, you know, sometimes $500,000. I mean, and go ask the executives of Fannie and Freddie what they were doing as these companies went down the tubes, you know. I mean, they're just getting, you know, so it's a horrible inside game. You know, no one's, the directors are supposed to be the check on management, at least the immediate check, but they don't have any stake in doing anything because they're their friends. They gave them this plum position. So I think you have to try to break that up to make sure that, you know, the shareholders, at least, as I say, have control over what management's doing and can hold them more directly accountable, because clearly it's not the case today.
You touched on Fannie and Freddie, if I can diverge to that. What do you think their role was in this crisis?
Well, they certainly aided the bubble, and you know, they continued to provide financing through it. Now, it's, you know, this idea that they were the leaders, that they were doing this because they wanted to extend home ownership. The evidence clearly contradicts that, because of course the worst loans were being securitized by the private issuers, and Fannie and Freddie eventually got to that market in 05, and they clearly did it in search of profits. They were losing market share like crazy, and I have a report from one, it was either Moody's or Standard & Poor's from 05 that was talking, I think it was about Freddie, saying that we would be concerned about their loss of market share, except they said they're going to get into, you know, these exotic
mortgages. Can we get a copy of that?
I'll see if I can find it. I have that somewhere.
Yeah, helpful.
Yeah, so anyhow, so you know, they played a bad role. They were not the worst actors. Now, what I would have liked to have seen, they were certainly powerful enough to have a huge impact on the market all by themselves. And if they had, say, done something, I think it's still a good idea, if you had mortgages issued based on price-to-rent ratios rather than just appraisals of, you know, rent, and you do a multiple of, and you could argue over what that multiple should be, and it might be different for different areas, perfectly be understandable. But if you had mortgages that were based on price-to-rent multiples, the bubble never would have gotten as far as it did. So if Fannie said, we're not going to issue a mortgage for any house that's being sold at, let's say, more than 18 times what its appraised annual rent is, well, that would have cut out the bottom from the market in, you know, Los Angeles, San Diego, Phoenix, you know, all of these areas, you know, as they start to get, you know, go through the stratosphere in their prices. So they could have acted, you know, I think, in responsible ways and had enormous impact in preventing the bubble from growing to the levels it did. So I see them as, you know, having been, you know, bad actors, but more followers than leaders. They were not the ones that were rushing out their securitizing subprime mortgages that were total junk. They later got into that, but they did that very clearly following the lead of the private issuers.
Can I ask you a question? I'm working with the writers group, and one of the writers asked me to ask you a question. Since you were part of the small tribe of Cassandras, can you identify some others among your group, others who...
Well, of course, Krugman, I'm very proud of that because he wrote his first column. I sent him one of my piece editor, and he said, why isn't everyone saying this? And I said, good question. But he did write a column about it, so that's very good. Of course, Schiller, you know him, obviously. I doubt I'd really name anyone you don't know. Rubini, of course. Well, I'm drawing a blank. There's at least one or two others I should be naming, and I'm just drawing a blank here.
Very small.
There weren't a lot, no. After the fact, there were many more.
Did you feel the pressure at the time of being this small, tiny minority of
Clarion
criers?
You know, I hate to say this, but I've been in the minority in these things before. You know, so with the stock market, for example, you know,
you were saying that earlier.
Yeah.
But you also said it made you a little mute at first.
Well, just in the sense of giving an end date. You know, so just realizing I don't know.
You said the sky was going to fall, but you didn't tell him when.
Exactly. I realized I don't know the date because you know my reason for saying that, it's not just not wanting to look wrong. The reality is if you're looking at a bubble that you're saying this is irrational, it can't go on. But because I'm saying it's irrational, I can't rationally say when irrationality will end. You know, so if everyone listens to me, of course, it ends tomorrow, but they're not going to. So when, you know, what will be the set of events in the world that will cause them to suddenly, you know, see the light of day and go, this doesn't make any sense? So, you know, that's what I realized, that, you know, just because I can look at it and go, this is crazy, doesn't mean it cares that I look at it and go, this is crazy. And, you know, it's on this path, you know, envision somewhere in the world, it's this path. I happen to notice it, and am I noticing it here, or am I noticing it here? I don't know. So that's why. So it wasn't that I was worried people saying I'd be, well, I don't want to look stupid, of course, but it wasn't that. It was just I honestly realized I can't say. Just because I could look at this and say it's irrational doesn't mean it's going to fall tomorrow.
Thank you.
Okay.
Y'all
set?
Yeah.
So one last question we like to ask anybody. Is there anything that the commission, from what you know that we've done, mm-hmm. or even if you don't know what we've done, is there anything that we should make sure in our final months to examine, investigate, highlight, focus on as we go forward and try to bring a report to the American people later this fall?
Well, this is here, you know, I know some of the things you've done, I don't know everything you've done, but I think focusing on what the regulators could have done with the power they had, particularly I'm thinking of the Fed, of course, because to my mind, I think it's very important to understand that as much as we need better regulation, I think we do, and we got some of that with the financial reform, the regulators had the power. You know, Greenspan had the power to stop this. And I think it's important to flesh that out for two reasons. One, just to, you know, the historical case that, you know, that they did have the power. But the second reason is that there's always going to be an issue. And even with the perfect set of regulations, we need the right set of incentives for regulators to actually do the right thing. Because as a practical matter, cracking down, you know, this bubble or any sort of excessive behavior, that's always going to put a regulator in a difficult position. Because if, you know, you can't tell Citigroup or Goldman or whoever it might be that they can't do something that's making them lots of money, and that's what it means, because you don't have to tell them not to do things that lose them money, you know, at least not in the short term. So if you have to tell them they can't do this, you know you're going to be put in a lot of hot water, because there's a powerful institutions, they have friends in Congress, the White House, the Treasury, wherever. So if you're going to do that, you're putting yourself in hot water. The easiest thing for a regulator in that sense is going to be look the other way, because there's always going to be an argument. I mean, there's never going to be a time where, you know, I saw, again, I haven't read this yet, but the Boston Fed just said something, well, it wasn't clear. Well, it's never going to be 100% clear. You're never, ever going to have that. So, you know, Goldman or Citi is always going to have someone who could get up there and make a very good case that whatever they're doing is just fine, they know how to manage risk and this and that. We have to make it so that the regulators understand that if they don't do what they should have done, and things blow up in their face, and you can't blow up in your face more than what just happened, that they'll pay a big price. And that's why I think it's really important to go through this and say, here's what the regulators could have done at this time, at that time, at that time, to prevent this whole thing from growing to the extent it did and blowing up. I think you have to...
You're talking about incentives in real time.
Yeah. I mean, we want... In this case, your power is only in a to do it retroactively. But I think it's important that it be set up so that regulators understand going forward. If you don't, you know, if you're in a position of regulatory responsibility, you have to act. You can't just look the other way.
Is the definition of a regulator is a watchdog who's empowered to avoid risk? Is it about their job?
Yes, absolutely.
So you're saying they need better incentives to do their jobs.
Exactly.
And what are those incentives?
Well, I think they have to know at the very least that, you know, someone should get fired when they don't do their jobs and it turns out badly. Again, this is one of the things I think is a real unfortunate aspect of this, that to my knowledge, none of the regulators, now maybe Greenspan would have been, you know, he'd been at the Fed forever, he was prepared to retire, you know, whatever, but to my knowledge, no one's been fired for this. And, you know, when I raise this with people, they think I've been vindictive, and, you know, I don't know most of these people at all. You know, it's pure and simply, if you don't do your job, you should get fired. And in this case, people really didn't do their job in a very big way.
Wasn't there also discussion that to do that would also have had an enormous consequence, that it would have roiled the markets, it would have upset
Absolutely.
The world global thinking about...
Yeah, well, we had gotten, this is why I think the responsibility lies first and foremost with the Fed. We had gotten on a very unhealthy growth path. So there's no way, you know, once you were down that path, even 2002, you know, where I was first talking about it, I don't think it, you know, had you burst the bubble that day, I think there had been very serious consequences, almost certainly a recession, not as bad as the one we have today, but almost certainly a recession. Going out more, 2003, 2004, the consequences would be much greater. But again, I think any clear-eyed analysis says, well, the consequence of, you know, taking the hit of 304 is much better than just pushing it down the road, because you aren't getting out of it by letting it go further.
To push this a little further, since the Fed is your target and it has two aspects to Fed behavior, do you have in mind a different monetary policy? So, for example, increasing rates earlier post the 2001 recession? Or are you thinking more along the lines, you know, the regulatory toolkit that they have, and particularly the authority under HOBA, perhaps?
I think the regulatory toolkit first. Also, I put a lot of emphasis on just calling attention to it. You know, and I don't mean, you know, I always say to some people, oh, you want Greenspan to say irrational exuberance. And I go, no. I don't care what he mumbles. Like, I think, I want him to document. You know, I began to lay out the case. Of course, I've written about this. Fed employs hundreds of economists. There's nothing more important they could have been doing during this period than documenting the existence of the bubble. And, you know, again, they can't force anyone to listen, but I don't think people could ignore the Fed. They could disagree, you know, they could say they're wrong, but I can't imagine that you've got people at Citigroup and JP Morgan that just go out and pay attention.
Were these economists mumbling or saying the wrong thing? What were they doing?
They were saying, well, there was one economist, I remember the vice president of the New York Fed put out a paper, said not only is there not a bubble, there isn't even an increase in house prices. It was just the problem in price measurement.
When?
This was in 04, I believe.
Okay. Yeah, we've been put onto that set of issues. We usually conclude, actually we're going to conclude this time the way we should have begun, which is if you can tell us, because this is for the record for being released in 5 years, if you could tell us a bit about yourself, sort of your professional background, your organization, when it got started, so we have that for the record. That would be quite helpful.
Okay. I'm an economist. I got my degree from the University of Michigan in 1988. I taught as an assistant professor at Bucknell University till 92. Went to work at the Economic Policy Institute as an economist there until 1998. I started my Center for Economic and Policy Research the end of 1999. And I've been co-director there since then.
Great. And can you talk a little about the center, the sort of what your focus is? And
so yeah, the center's an independent nonprofit think tank. We do research, both global issues, international issues, and also domestic. It's a small center, so we have at the moment 4 economists on staff. We'll soon have a 5th. We do a fair bit on labor economics. I've done work on Social Security and macro issues like the stock bubble and housing bubble. I'm trying to think of other areas. We've gone off in some other areas like intellectual property rights and sort of random areas that we occasionally have purpose to get into.
Great. Thank you very much.
Sure, I enjoyed it.